Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Today's business leaders are saying that sustainability and diversity metrics are key to the way they do business, but what does that look like in practice? Stick around until the end of this episode to hear more.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is The Jack Pod, where On Point news analyst Jack Beattie helps us connect history, literature, and politics in his unique way that brings clarity to the world we live in now. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Meghna.
We have arrived at episode 33. What's your headline?
The One Apple Tasted.
The One Apple Tasted. Okay, so what's the apple referring to?
Well, it's a quotation from John Milton in Paradise Lost, and it goes this way. It was from out the rind of the one apple tasted that the knowledge of good and evil, as two twins cleaving together, leaped forth into the world.
So a biblical reference about good and evil leaping into the world, what does that have to do with, what does it not have to do with where our lives today, Jack?
Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about a book that's just been published called Illiberal America, A History by Stephen Hahn, a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian at NYU. And this book is of the most penetrating relevance to today because, of course, it is a sort of archaeology of the forces, impulses, the traditions that explain and that inform Trumpism, which is a sort of summa of illiberalism in the American tradition. And I use the Milton quote because one of the important analytical distinctions that Hahn makes in this book is illiberalism, which we'll define, is not just a reaction to liberalism. That's the usual way of putting it. You know, the civil rights movement, there was a white backlash and so on. No, these two traditions, liberalism and illiberalism, coexist. They are the two twins cleaving together. Each has its own, as he puts it, field of cultural and political force. So it's not as if one is a reaction to the other. It's that they're both part of the political culture of the United States of America, and that they go back to the settlement of the country. And his book is a history of that entwinement of liberalism with illiberalism.
Oh, that's interesting. I'm going to ask you later about whether that thesis means or implies that one will never fully triumph over the other. But you're right, Jack. We should probably define terms here. So first of all, when Stephen Hahn talks about illiberalism, how does he define it? And do you agree with his definition?
Well, first of all, he defines liberalism as the movement, what did Barack Obama always say, toward a more perfect union, the extension of rights to people on the margin of society, the bringing in to the American feast of more and more different people, and in that way, working toward the more perfect union. That would be the liberal tradition. Illiberalism, which... And he says the history of illiberalism's history is the history of the United States. He defines illiberalism this way. Illiberalism celebrates hierarchies of gender, race, and nationality, cultural homogeneity, Christian religious faith, the making of internal as well as external enemies, patriarchal families, heterosexuality, the will of the community over the rule of law, and the use of political violence to achieve or maintain power. Mm. That is the set of ideas and impulses that defines American illiberalism. Joe Biden put it pretty well in his State of the Union when he said, hate, anger, revenge, retribution, are among the oldest ideas. And in America, that is simply a true statement. Mm. And this book brings out in detail, rich, thick detail, this tradition of illiberalism in America.
Yeah, so Jack, as you said a minute or two ago, that you see this tradition of liberalism and illiberalism having been with the nation since, well, even prior to its official founding, from the initial settlement of what became the United States of America. So what are some of those quick early examples?
Well, one of the things he points out is that, you know, it's usually said that, in fact, it's been written, capitalism came over on the first ships. And capitalism understood as the form of economic life that superseded feudalism. Well, it would be closer to the truth, and indeed the truth, to say feudalism came over on the first ships. Hahn tells us that of the 800,000 people who'd come to British North America between the Pilgrims and the Revolution, of that 800,000, fully 600,000 came in conditions of unfreedom, either as African, from Africa as slaves, or as white indentured servants. And the white indentured servant class in America was at least in its beginnings, as exploited as the slave. And in a monstrously mischievous way, master-servant jurisprudence spun off from that indentured servitude that lasted into the early Republic with terrible consequences for the poorest Americans. So the point is, we were founded in almost in feudal relations, not in capitalist relations. And from the start, these settlements were marked by exclusions and expulsions and sort of religiously and culturally inscribed boundaries. I accept you, but not you. And also by the use of force. Forced to maintain great estates, whether with white indentured servants or black slaves, and essentially the government, such as it was, backing up the use of force against people down below.
So that makes perfect sense in terms of the first settlements, in terms of the non-indigenous, of course, settlements in the United States. But Jack, I'd like to jump forward to the founding of the nation post-revolution, because I still adhere to the belief that the Declaration of Independence is one of the greatest documents ever written, because within it, it's the first, I would say, and purest sort of pre-governmental description of a nation under the rule of law, right? The belief that there are natural laws by which all humankind have a natural set of rights, right? I mean, that's kind of the ideal undergirding of what it means to be an American, the common belief in that. Whether or not we've executed that belief or, you know, carried out that belief consistently is a different story. So, I mean, would you think of that period of time and the formation of the ideals that were supposed to make their way from the Declaration into the Constitution a triumph of a moment where liberalism at least outshone that illiberal sort of Jekyll and Hyde twin?
Well, it certainly was the liberal hour, but as Hahn writes about the passage of the 13th Amendment after the Civil War, illiberal chords chimed in the liberal hour. And that has happened again and again in the history that he shows, how moments of moving toward a more perfect union are entwined with retrograde movements. Thus, at the founding, of course, slavery, the compromises made to it, the limits on the franchise, the whole apparatus of democratic distrust that is the American Constitution, these were, well, it's hard to square them with any idea of a robust democracy. So there was illiberalism melded in, entwined, even at that high hour. And the illiberal tradition in the early republic really came strikingly to the fore in the 1830s. And that is a period that is more relevant to our current dilemma than any other. He writes, the 1830s were a time when expulsionism proved to be a popular solution to the social problems presented by African Americans, Catholics, Mormons, Masons, and Native peoples, indeed, by any group capable of defying the hegemony of a white Christian republic. And he shows how, you know, the Mormons were driven out, Masons were persecuted, Catholics were, convents were burnt, Native peoples were extruded, even the Cherokee, of course, who had assimilated, like today's many undocumented immigrants today, they had deeply assimilated into the American ways. Heck, they even owned slaves. They were that American. And that didn't prevent them being shifted to Oklahoma, what we call Oklahoma today, by force on the Trail of Tears, because illiberalism, the view that you know, the blood of the country was being poisoned by these groups, and the way to handle them was to expel them, and that really, that part of the illiberal tradition is the most relevant to our own, into our own situation.
Okay, so let's then just drive straight at the relevance. I presume you're intimating Trump's very open call to what he would do to, what, the 11 million or so undocumented immigrants in this country should he return to the White House.
Yes, I am. And there's an outstanding Times piece of November 2023. The title pretty much gives away what you're talking about. Sweeping raids, giant camps, and mass deportations, Trump's plans for the second term. You know, Trump has been, his rhetoric has, of course, been intensifying and deepening in its vileness and in its violence. He's talked about the immigrants today poisoning the blood of our country. He's compared the migrants to Hannibal Lecters. He said at one time, they're not people. They're not people. Just an aside, what he has in mind is the would be the largest forcible deportation possibly in any country in history. You know, when you look at precedents, one might be, and it's cited often, what Stalin did in 1944 to the Crimean Tatars. He suspected them of collaboration with the Nazis. It was a conspiracy theory. There was no evidence of that. Nevertheless, they were packed on, a quarter of a million of them were packed on boxcars and shipped to Central Asia, nearly half dying on the trip, just removed from the population. That's a quarter of a million. Trump means to dig out 10 million people. He means to deport forcibly millions a year. And he means to hold the people while they're waiting for their, quote, rights, their moment, you know, am I going to get asylum and so on. He means to hold them in vast camps along the border where they'll wait for their adjudication. They will be rounded up in raids. And the raids, Trump has said, and his man Stephen Miller, who's leading up this effort and promises to be really the driving force of it in the second Trump term, they envision calling on red state governors to volunteer their National Guards to go into blue states and go to workplaces where undocumented workers are suspected of and round them up his Trump. He says, following the Eisenhower model, we will carry out the largest deportation operation in American history. He's referring to a 1954 operation. It's called Operation Wetback at the time, which was a forcible use of the National Guard all over the country to gather up 1.3 million basically Mexican migrants, many of whom, if not all of whom, had come into the country as legal agricultural laborers, and they were forcibly shipped back to Mexico. In Texas, about a quarter of the immigrants deported were crammed into boats that were later compared to slave ships, while others died. This was in July of 1954, died of sunstroke disease and sundry other causes while they were in custody. Trump means to do this every year to get out these people who are infecting the blood of our country. This would also include the tens of thousands of Afghans who were evacuated with U.S. personnel after the Taliban took over. And Trump, you know, he has mused aloud about shooting migrants crossing the border in the legs. And he's mused aloud about topping his border wall with, quote, flesh-piercing spikes and paint it black to burn the migrants' skin. Bottom line, says Stephen Miller, President Trump will do whatever it takes. And whatever it takes would, and why? What's driving this other than Trump's sadistic streak, which is documented all the way back in his life? No, it's the replacement theory, right? Mm-hmm. Who are these 10 million? They are the replacements. They are the people who are going to take, who are taking our jobs, who want, who will eventually vote, who will take over the white Christian United States. We are going to get rid of them before they replace us. So it looks like it's an offensive measure, but really it's defending us against the great replacement, rooting these people out of our lives, and creating through expulsion the triumphant illiberal republic.
So, well, Jack, I go back to what you described as Hahn is writing in his book, that the liberalism and the illiberalism have been part of this country's history from its inception. But it also sounds like they wax and wane in terms of what spirit is ascendant or not. I think you make a really good case about illiberalism being ascendant now. But when you look back at history, Jack, what did it take to then have liberalism sort of surge back to the fore?
Well, I think one thing it took was a mass unemployment. You know, Hahn's chapter on the 1920s really shows how incipient fascism was catching on everywhere in America, led by the monstrously large Ku Klux Klan of the era, and another one of those cases of they didn't have red hats, but white hoods. And they marched in New York City for the Democratic National Convention. They rode high, and not just them. I mean, all through the 20s. And the, you know, intellectuals were, you know, worshiping Russian communism and bowing down to Mussolini and so on. And so what happened? Well, what happened? And the country was, you know, poised against the city in a seemingly, you know, death struggle where, you know, prohibition, don't let them drink, you know, gangsters in the city, cities as dens of iniquity. The picture that Sinclair Lewis draws, especially in Elmer Gantry, of you know, rural revivals as aimed at sin and drink and all the things that are undermining America. What happened? What healed the breach between country and city and ended the politics of provincialism of the 1920s? A Great Depression. a great engulfing economic catastrophe that struck country and city, immigrant and old American, Catholic and Protestant and Jew, that struck everybody. And that and we had a leader who was able to sort of say to the people, we're all in this together. And you know, there was a famous hobo, as they were called in the era, talked about putting chalk on the wall of a freight car saying, you know, the president cares about us, meaning FDR. He made people feel that way, but it wasn't so much FDR as the crisis that suddenly brought people together. And that crisis was superseded by another, the World War, which World War II, which you talk about bringing people together, you know, it in a struggle, in what seemed to be a struggle for national existence. So these were two solidarity enforcing historical events, unlike any other in American history, that pushed illiberalism off to the side and brought to the fore a sense of we were all in this together.
Yeah. One would think that the 2008 financial crisis and COVID and its attendant crises would have also been solidarity-producing events, but that did not happen. That's for another podcast. That's for another jackpot in a future week. But let me actually bring this one to a close here in terms of the first half, because this is the question I want to ask all of you jackpotters today. And that is, let's accept that, you know, Jack's analysis and Hans' analysis as well of illiberalism being in illiberalism being on the rise and, you know, finding its apotheosis in Donald Trump is in fact happening in this country. So what do you think it would take to push illiberalism into a decline, right? To let the better angels, the more little the little L liberal angels of this country's history rise again. So that's what we want to know. That's what I want to know from all you jackpotters. So you know the drill. Go to your phones. Go to the On Point Vox Pop app if you don't already have it. Go to wherever you get your apps and look for On Point Vox Pop and let us know what you think in your response to this week's jackpot. And Jack, as I say every week, we get a ton of responses from folks. Last week was no exception when you had a fantastic conversation with Dory, our senior editor. I keep ribbing her that she's gunning for my job, but I'm still here, Dory. I'm still here. But it was a terrific conversation. We got a lot of response, and we'll hear from Jack Potters on that right when we come back.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. In a recent episode, Series CEO Mindy Luber says sustainability has reached a board level.
Look, if you're an agricultural company and you're not thinking about water risk, you're an apparel company, you're not thinking about risk to your cotton crop around the world, if you're a bank and not thinking about stranded assets of fossil fuels, you're not probably doing your due diligence.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
Well, Jack, we're back. And last week, in your conversation with Dory Scheimer, our senior editor, you two talked about the Make America Great Again hats, the red ones, and what they symbolize. And then you guys asked Jack Potters what they think the red hat means.
To me, in 2024... the MAGA red hat means insurrection and a cleaving of communities.
For me, as a Black woman, it means danger.
It's complicated.
I think that the red hat has an enormous meaning that wasn't there several years ago.
And the red MAGA hat is both a symbol of intolerance and community.
To me, the red hat is interchangeable with the white pointy dunce hat.
So that was Keith in Point Pleasant, New Jersey, Jean in New York City, Ellen in Sharon, Massachusetts, James in Minneapolis, Minnesota, Kyle in Denver, Colorado, and Miles in Austin, Texas. Just a few of the jackpotters who gave us their impressions of what that red hat means. So we have a couple of more here, Jack. This is from Rebecca Rose Langston. She's in Northampton, Massachusetts.
Even thinking of it as a symbol of belonging, which could be benign, also makes me think about how human nature kind of leads us to see difference as threatening often, and that there's a really, really thin line between symbols of belonging and hating the people who don't belong.
Jack, I think Rebecca has really, really hit something right on the head there. What do you think?
Oh, I think she catches the paradox. It's something positive about the feeling of belonging. And Dory last week brought out how, that affiliation created by the red hat comes at a time when loneliness is a scourge for so many people. So yes, it's a little bit like our two twins cleaving together. But on the other side, it's I've got the red hat and you don't. It's like, I'm Chevy Chase and you're not. It used to be the Saturday Night Live. And this idea of exclusion seems to be just built into inclusion, outgroup and in-group. I don't know what a universal hat would look like, but I tried to put the history of the red hat, or the current history, in perspective of the sort of the efflorescence of shirts in the 1930s, indicating a sort of rainbow of different kinds of fascisms everywhere. And these shirts with their blue and their green and their yellow and their this and their that, they showed people were belonging and in groups, but they also sent that message of terror and exclusion.
You know, when Rebecca said that there's a really thin line between those symbols of belonging and hating the people who don't belong, that reminded me of a conversation I had many years ago with now the late E.O. Wilson, right? The really one of the greatest biologists of our time. And he had written yet another book about pro-social behavior and how ants and human beings share that in common, right? We are very pro-social. And that's actually one of the reasons why we're so successful as a species. But that book, he talked way more about, the leap from the biological necessity of pro-social behavior to how human beings have mutated it, right? Because we ended up talking about baseball hats, believe it or not. Because I was like, what purpose does everybody, where we are, Jack, wearing a Red Sox hat, what purpose does that serve? And he said it serves absolutely no purpose from the point of view of the survival of the species. And that's where human beings depart in terms of the rationale of belonging. And it was so fascinating to me because Jack, I got to admit this, just the other week, I went to a Red Sox game for the only the second time in my whole life. I think baseball is probably the most boring sport in the world. I honestly went just for the hot dogs and the beer. We were in the bleacher seats. I was with with some kids. But here's why I bring this up, not to get all the fans of professional baseball on my case. Jack was one of them, by the way. But anyway, I bought 4 Red Sox hats. I bought
Isn't
one for me
something?
And 3 for the kids.
And isn't that something?
It cost me more than a pretty penny, but it felt good. That's what it felt good to put that cap on and walk into Fenway Park and look like everybody else. It was a very powerful feeling.
What a moment. I mean, that immediately puts you in touch with the red hat. That's the feeling.
Exactly. The instant community. Mm-hmm. Now, am I going to take the next step and call the Yankees the evil empire? Maybe not. I don't care about baseball that much. But I can see, like, intrinsically, you can see how that line that Rebecca's talking about is oh so delicately thin. Even for those of us who like to think of ourselves as perhaps more open-minded. But anyway, so let's move on to Kyle. This is Kyle Pontieri in Denver, Colorado. And he says, oh, well, speaking of firsthand experience, he says he has firsthand experience with what the red hat means.
It's sending a message, a provocative message to those who disagree in hopes that it can provoke violence in a way that the wearers can feel justified in having their power fantasy of proving they're the true American by putting others down. And I kind of get that from my family members who wear and are proud of the red hat as well. It's why I'm honestly scared of talking about politics with them, because violence is so clearly part of what they desire out of politics.
There it is, Jack, isn't it?
Oh, my gosh. You know, first listening to him, I'm thinking, you're positing something here. You're projecting something, right? It isn't all that bad. And then he grounds it in his own experience and in the authority of that experience. He's seen it. He's felt it. And I quoted somebody on the web who's saying, you know, I wear the red hat hoping someone will try to knock it off my head. So, yeah, there's a chip, people with the chips on their shoulders and the red hats. It can send that message of incipient, barely held in check violence. I wonder if I could just end with one quote. This is a quote from Hubert Humphrey. We must create a climate of identity of interest between the needs, the hopes, and fears of minorities and the needs and hopes and fears of the majority. An identity of interest. And Humphrey, the recent biography, brings out, tried forever to do that, to connect, liberalism in the largest sense of expansion of rights with middle America. Isn't this what you folks believe too? That was his kind of his, let's not demonize each other. Let's have a conversation across difference and with respect and attending to each other's fears and finding in them perhaps some common ground.
Well, Jack, that is the way that I prefer ending every episode of the Jack Pod. Thank you for keeping my helping keep my my always hopeful American optimism alive for another week, Jack.
Thanks, happy Jack. To do it.
All right. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this has been the Jack Pod from On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Mindy Luber, CEO of Ceres, a nonprofit dedicated to integrating sustainability into businesses. Here's host Kurt Nickisch.
Are the people who are working with ESG data now at companies, are they in a sustainability department? Does this just become part of general strategy or part of finance? How is that evolution happening with the actual people who are looking and working with the numbers?
So with both companies and investors, the cute idea of social responsibility that was at a manager level or something their foundations dealt with, that's gone. It is very clear based on data, based on facts, based on trends, that integrating sustainability into the core business is crucial. I mean, you cannot have a climate goal that says we're going to get to a net zero by 2040 if every department at the enterprise is not working on that. That's your manufacturing people. It's your supply chain people. So we find that there is often a sustainability team, but they're laying out a plan that involves almost every enterprise, every office, every part of a firm. And that's what we're seeing, because nobody can do the kind of cross-organizational work in one little group. It involves the entire team. It involves HR. Who are you hiring? Is DEI being implemented? How is that working? As it relates to where do you get your resources? Are there enough natural resources to make your product? What are the auto companies doing now that they've committed to by 2035, there will be no combustion engine vehicles coming off their assembly line for consumer vehicles? So sustainability is no longer a cute, a niche, a part of something off to the side. It is an integral part of almost every major enterprise and every major investor.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.